First of all, let's head to London and see what shape Ian is in. Still carousing, Mr. Dunt?
Yes, I mean, the Dunt household is now participating in a sort of randomised, double-blind scientific experiment in how much champagne it's possible to drink while under lockdown. The results have been brilliant, absolutely fantastic.
I must say, I have enjoyed your tweets during this period. They've been most exhilarating. Now, is the same exhilaration being felt at number 10?
No, it isn't. So Boris Johnson, you know, of course, the master of unforced errors, has made a number of them leading up to the moment where Joe Biden was going to become president. I mean, the first one, of course, goes years back, which is when he made these racist statements about Barack Obama, where he said, you know, he had an ancestral dislike of Britain because of his part Kenyan heritage. And just that, you know, when he made it, you could just feel your soul leave your body. And now, as if we're suddenly living in a rather righteous reality where one actually faces the consequences of one's words, he is now going to have to do precisely that, because these sentences were not forgotten in Obama's camp. And of course, that includes Biden. So there is a personal problem there. There's also the political problem. I mean, Joe Biden views Boris Johnson correctly as a variant on the Trump archetype. He views Brexit as a terrible strategic mistake and part of that nationalist wave that went across the world. So relationships there are frosty. And of course, then there's the final piece of the puzzle, which is arguably the most important, which is that Biden's heart is in Ireland. You know, he considers himself Irish, considers himself that to be of absolute chief strategic importance when you're looking at the issue of Brexit. And most of the moves which have sort of followed from Britain's departure from the EU have had an effect on the Good Friday Agreement, on the Irish peace process. So on that basis, no, Boris Johnson has rather a difficult sort of problem to deal with now that there's a new administration.
Do we know what he actually said when he made the g'day call to Joe?
Well, we have two versions. It's been just the most depressing. I mean, it's like watching toddlers organise a birthday party. So, you know, the British government, very, very keen to be the first people that were called in Europe, and put out, you know, these statements once the phone call had taken place, saying, look, this is what we talked about. No mention of the Good Friday Agreement, the Northern Ireland peace process, and saying, oh, we were called first. Then the Biden camp put out their list of people they've spoken to in Europe, Macron, Merkel, and eventually at the bottom of the list, Boris Johnson. So you sort of get these two versions where people are now doing this forensic assessment of where people come on the list of who was spoken to when. All very, very depressing. And yet, in the Biden account of the conversation, yes, the Good Friday Agreement was mentioned. So already you're getting these very, very different messages put out by the two sides.
Now, let's go back on Joe Biden's historical interest in Ireland. It's multi-pronged, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, but ultimately, his concern is the correct one. And it is the one that is shared in the Republic of Ireland. It's the one that's shared in Brussels. And that was, you know, Theresa May was one of the worst prime ministers this country has ever had. But to her credit, she shared this problem too. Now, it's fundamentally, it's the same old story that we've heard a million times with Brexit, which is the EU consists of a single market and a customs union. Now, that kind of trading entity has borders. You know, it has a point at which goods come into the territory, they might have to pay tariffs, they suddenly have to have regulatory checks, they have to be checked for their tariff status. That is a customs border. And that border has to go somewhere. So if Britain was leaving, it could either go right down the middle of the island of Ireland, between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU, or it could go in the Irish Sea, or Britain could, you know, stay in the EU single market and customs union. They weren't going to do the last. They didn't want to do the second, and they absolutely couldn't do the first, because the first went against the Good Friday Agreement. It suggested the Good Friday Agreement was ultimately a compromise. It said to people, look, you accept the status quo as it is right now, unless you can get enough support for a referendum on Irish unification. But in exchange, we will make sure that the island of Ireland functions as a single entity on things like energy, on things like trade. You can't start pulling those two pieces apart. And Biden's concern, and indeed the concern of many other people, is now that Britain is passing laws that say that it gets to tear up the agreement it made with the EU, that it would put the border in the Irish Sea, the natural consequence, the natural end point of that process is that the border will end up on the island of Ireland. And that really is where the heat of the matter lies at the moment.
Just reminding you, dear listener, that Biden was a key player in the peace process, inviting Gerry Adams to the US against British wishes, and that proved to be a pivotal point in the IRA turning away from violence. The last time we spoke, the Internal Markets Bill was working its way through the system. Yesterday, the House of Lords rejected it decisively. Another blow for Boris?
It is indeed. I mean, look, so this Internal Markets Bill, this is the mechanism by which the British government is trying to put itself above international law. There's five clauses in particular that do this, that give ministers that power. And indeed, domestic law, specifically when it comes to the Northern Ireland Protocol, which was in the sort of divorce agreement with the EU. Now, that has now gone through the Lords. It's been defeated by historic margins and plenty of Conservative peers coming in, you know, including some very right-wing figures, like former Tory leader Michael Howard, the man who was famously described by Anne Widdecombe as having something of the night about him. This very, you know, sort of shadowy Conservative right-wing figure. Even he was just thinking, like, well, look, this is too far. You know, we can't be putting forward legislation that puts the government above the law. That breaks very, very fundamental principles of the manner in which Britain and indeed Western democracy operates. So that's been rejected. Now, that was an interesting moment, because the Biden administration, the Biden camp, had made it clear to the Brits, you cannot have those clauses in that bill, or else we're not going to give you a free trade agreement. Now, it then provided an opportunity, and arguably, by the way, you could say the same thing for the Europeans. It would make a deal much easier with them to be able to say, look, we've dropped these clauses giving us power to break international law. But Boris Johnson didn't take it, because he had a moment there. He had a moment this week where the House of Lords said, we're taking those out. The rest of the bill can stay, but we're getting rid of those five contentious clauses. He could have let the matter drop, patched things up with Washington, or the future Washington, and patched things up with the EU. But he chose not to do it, because he knows ultimately that he has a pretty hefty minority of his own MPs who are really going to die in the ditch on this stuff, who are very, very heavily pro-Brexit. And he is, at the moment, evidently more scared of them than he is of becoming the enemy of both Brussels and Washington at the same side. So we've still got really the most sort of out there extremist elements of the Conservative Party are still the people formulating government policy.
An echo of Oliver Twist. I understand there's been a win for disadvantaged kids who will now be fed courtesy of the state.
Yes, well, the Tory government decided that having now inflicted as much political damage on itself as it can possibly achieve, it might as well do a U-turn. So this goes back to the story where, you know, you have free school meals over the holiday during the COVID period, because hard-up families are much more hard-up than they have been previously. In many parts of the country, they've been on 60% of wages where they've been on lockdown. Now that there's a full national lockdown, it's 80%. But of course, for many people, they couldn't live on their previous wages, let alone 80%. Of them. So this was a long campaign done by the footballer Marcus Rashford, supported by almost everyone. I mean, rival football teams, charities, private companies, even McDonald's, you know, was out there, the great socialist entity of McDonald's, you know, telling the government you're making a terrible error here. Weeks and weeks of bad headlines on that. And then very quietly, right in the heat of the US elections, the government did its U-turn and gave in. They very often do this. They seem to desire to inflict as much damage on themselves as possible before they decide to engage in the humiliation of a U-turn. It's a rather extraordinary manner to behave, but nevertheless, one which they do with alarming regularity.
Talking about turns, Keir Starmer, if you don't mind, and on Corbyn.
Yeah, so we're still, unfortunately, in this moment of intense tribalism in Labour, which is revealed more starkly, I think, for the manner of how effectively sort of the Bernie Sanders lot in the US managed to work with the more centrist elements of the Democrat Party to secure their result. I'm sorry to say that there's no evidence of the same thing happening in the Labour Party, where the left and the centre of the party are continually at war. There's now been a report on anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn. Part of that report said, look, A, there was a tremendous problem in this party. And secondly, the problem was allowed to spread not just by anti-Semites, but by a leadership structure that refused to accept there was a problem and instead said that it was all a conspiracy drummed up by our political opponents in the media. Now, what was remarkable then was that on the day the report was published, Jeremy Corbyn comes out and releases a statement basically doing exactly that, saying, you know, this is all exaggerated. It was all by our political enemies, which put Keir Starmer, the current Labour leader, in a position of saying, well, you've got to go. I mean, you've sort of forced my hand. You've done exactly the thing that I have just said no one can do if we're to deal with anti-Semitism, which led to Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader, being suspended from the party that he was leading just a few months ago. And of course, now a degeneration of Labour into that standard left versus centre internecine warfare that we've seen for so many years now. They are deeply in it. And I don't see any signs of them taking the lessons from the US of what the Labour Party needs to do in terms of unity in order to be victorious in the next election.
I note that Farage is still muttering pro-Trumpian, but he's re-emerging on your stage as well.
Yes, he's been all over the place. So he's been doing, as you say, he went to the US to campaign for Trump. I mean, God on earth knows what the sort of Republicans at that speech thought when they brought up this fairly insignificant British figure to start chanting for Trump. And back home, he is setting up a new anti-lockdown party. This is his idea, Reform, it's called. Which is going to sort of campaign against lockdowns and coronavirus. Now, this is obviously quite ironic. I mean, Nigel Farage was actually talking about the requirement of a lockdown not so many months ago, but he's clearly looked at the numbers and thought, look, there's a decent little demographic chunk here that I can appeal to. They're not a majority, actually about a fifth of the population, if sometimes less, who are critical of lockdown measures. But he thinks that he can actually get a bit of progress with that group. So he's setting up a party that's going to be very, very pro-Brexit, obviously, very, very anti-lockdown and very anti-immigration. It's unlikely he will secure any political success by going down this road. However, he's quite good at pushing the Conservative Party to become more right-wing by presenting a threat on its right flank. That, after all, is how he secured Brexit. So this could be a troubling moment, even though it probably isn't an electorally significant one.
Good on you, Ian. We'll talk again in a couple of weeks. LNL's regular commentator, Ian Dunt, author of that splendid tome, How to Be a Liberal.